I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Seventh Movement, Reflections in Transition. By Benjamin D. Hutchins, that's me, and Chris Overstreet, with Anne Cross. Theme from Battlecruiser Vengeance by John M. Ford. Tuesday, May 3rd, 2405, 8:44 a.m. CFMF Charlemagne, on station at Babylon 5, Epsilon Eridania System. One of the plagues of an admiral's rank is paperwork. Reports must be read, acknowledged, and responded to. Pay chits must be authorized. The discipline of the ship, or fleet, must be attended to, which means review of every ship's captain's mast and, occasionally, the impaneling of courts-martial. Reports, in turn, must be written for those higher up the command chain, detailing operations, endorsing promotions or demotions, and requesting resupply or refit. Aya Nakajima attacked paperwork with the same sort of mentality she applied to any other attack. She cut straight to what she felt was important, and did it so thoroughly that the slapdash handling of the minor details was overlooked. In this system, Aya handled military action reports, court-martial-level discipline, and absolutely nothing else, throwing all the maintenance responsibilities back onto the captains and rubber-stamping the results. In the past year, she had applied the same system to reports coming up to her as 2nd Division Commander from the 7th, 8th, and 9th Task Forces. The system might not have been the best in the galaxy, but it did work. For any combat reports from the other task forces in the 2nd Division, Aya would usually endorse, "I wasn't there, this guy was, he's probably right." Only if her orders were directly and flagrantly violated in a non-productive way did Aya take a personal, and usually vindictive, interest. Within the task force she personally commanded, she gave her captains her full support, having had 10 years to weed out the incompetent and unmotivated officers. With her detailed attention to their combat reports, and the loose but firm discipline she mandated, her aides were easily able to catch anything she missed. It is for this reason that, having begun the morning briefing and paperwork session at 0800 hours fleet time, also P5's time, Aya had either cleared through what could be cleared or set aside those items which couldn't by 0837, stood on the Charlemagne's main transporter pads by 0844, and found herself on the bridge of IPS Challenger, the command deck of Babylon 5, and finally the Babylon 5 extension of the CFA New Orleans's Bazaar, nicknamed the Zocalo by the Bajoran workers, at 0846, 0847, and 0849 hours, respectively. The Zocalo was by no means as impressive a sight as the Bazaar, or Bazaars, on the New Orleans. For one thing, you could see its beginning and end without straining the eyes across half a kilometer or more of broad corridor. For another thing, all the stands were obviously of a temporary nature, easily taken down and moved. Nothing really heavy or bulky which wasn't equipped with a repulsor lift. However, despite the fading Freespacer work presence on the station, the Zocalo showed no signs of going away, and in fact some Bajorans and other local inhabitants had begun setting up their own stores nearby. After a couple of minutes of searching, Aya found Griffin at one of the several Freespacer-owned construction roach coaches on the inner edge of the Zocalo. The first of the station's restaurants would open for business in a couple of weeks, at which point the caterers would move on to some other space habitat job. For now, however, they continued providing cheap, hot food to the shrinking construction crew and growing station staff. Griffin was juggling his usual breakfast when on station, Tangberry Danish, hash browns, black tea, when Aya snatched away his paper cup of tea with one hand, grabbed the empty hand in the other, and pumped it firmly up and down. "Way to go, Griffin! Banzai!" she exclaimed. Aya was at her most chipper this morning, her smiling face and perky expression almost more than Captain Benjamin Hutchins could handle. He'd spent the prior evening making certain that Earth Force really was standing down from any possible intention of storming Babylon 5, and had collapsed into his seldom-used bunk in Blue Sector when Ruri had finally threatened him with phaser stun if he didn't get some rest. As a result, his brain was either in that Blue Sector bed or in his bunk on Challenger, or sweet thought of thoughts, luxuriating on the pillow of his soft, cozy bed in New Avalon. And not at all in the Zocalo, certainly not looking slightly down at Aya Nakajima's cute, maniacal smile and victory pose. For a moment, just a moment, the I'm in bed image and the, oh, it's Aya image, blended into something quite interesting. But his, no, that can't be right, filter caught and purged it almost immediately. More was the pity. Aya, he gasped, buying time while his brain made the commute back to his skull.
What? My arm?
Oh! Aya released his hand at last, belatedly restoring his beverage to him as she added,
I watched the whole escape. I couldn't believe how you dodged all those mindsats, and then, berserk, you blew up the interdiction satellite. You squeezed a reflex cannon into that little ship. I can't believe it. Can I have one?
Griffin's brain had finally arrived, but in metaphorical terms its tie was askew and its briefcase spilled all over the office floor. Aya, Aya, he said, waving her down. Slow up just a bit and start at the beginning. I don't have the first idea what you're talking about.
Your rescue,
Aya said, coming off like nothing so much as an overexcited child.
You folded out of nowhere in Dagger Disc and swooped down and...
Oh, Griffin said, comprehension dawning. He took a bite of his Danish, chewed, swallowed, and then said, Sorry, but that wasn't me. Aya's jaw dropped slightly.
You mean you didn't put a reflex cannon in Dagger Disc?
Griffin couldn't help chuckling. Get your mind out of your big gun fixation, Aya. Yes, I did. No, you can't have one. And I wasn't the one at the controls. I was right here in this system, wondering why the Earth Force tactical band had suddenly gone all noisy. The one doing the hotshot driving was my son.
Leonard?
Aya scratched her head, looking very puzzled.
I didn't think he was interested in ships. Destroids, yes, but not ships.
No, not Len.
Not Guy. He's only, what, 10?
Almost 12, but no, it was Corwin, actually. Aya's jaw dropped again, still further.
Little Corwin? Scold's son? I haven't seen him in years.
He's grown, Griffin said, shrugging. He's the same age as Len, you know. Aya took a moment to absorb this information, then smiled again.
Well, she declared, I promised to shake the hand of the men who pulled off that escape, and I am going to do just that.
Grabbing Griffin's arm, Aya pulled him away from the catering booth, saying, Now come on! It's nearly 0900 and I'm running late! Shrugging, Griffin scarfed down his breakfast as she hauled him through the corridors of the station, much to the amusement of various passing station personnel. They wound up in the docking bay where Dagger Disc was berthed. From outside, there didn't seem to be anyone around. Someone had been there, the wreckage of the comm dish was almost completely removed from the upper hull, and several of the nastier scorch marks were gone. But no one was in evidence now. Griffin went to the base of the ramp, looked up inside, and yelled, Corwin! From inside came the sounds of feet on deck plates, and then Corwin appeared, dressed in a slightly dirty gray technician's coverall, and carrying what looked like about half of a deflector shield emitter head. Yeah? He said as he came down the ramp. Griffin started to say, I've got someone here who'd like to... Aya, eyes going wide, gasped, then seized Corwin's free hand, heedless of the fact that it was rather dirty, and pumped it vigorously.
Oh my goodness, look at you! She said. The boy who put the Solo twins to shame, how are you? I haven't seen you since you were this high! She added with the appropriate gesture. Wow! I'm going to get a crick in my neck if you grow any more!
As Corwin attempted to formulate a response to this onslaught, there came the sound of more footsteps from behind him, and then Utena Tenjo rounded the corner from the aft engine compartment. She wore one of her old Otori Academy uniform jackets over Martian Army fatigue pants, and had somehow contrived to keep it relatively clean, though she had managed to acquire a smear of grease on one cheek from somewhere.
"Oh, you must be Corwin's girlfriend," said Aya with a broad smile, which caused both of them to blush furiously.
Well, said Corwin. At the same time, Utena offered, "That's not..." But I wasn't listening. She grabbed Utena's hands too, wrung them, and looked her up and down with undisguised admiration.
"You're so cute! I like that shade of pink, and that uniform is so cool!"
She leaned nearer as if imparting a confidence and said, "I looked ridiculous in my school uniform, and it was worse when I got out. Starfleet was still using the booty PJs until my second year out of the academy." Said Utena. Aya blinked, then smacked herself in the forehead. "Oh, I'm sorry, how rude of me." She squared herself up and saluted smartly. "Vice Admiral Ayami Nakajima, Confederate Free Spacers Mercenary Fleet."
"Nice to meet you, Admiral. I'm Utena Tenjo."
Aya dropped the military pose effortlessly, grinned, and said, "Oh, I've known Corwin since he was knee-high. I think it's okay if his girlfriend calls me Aya."
"Well..."
"Corwin," said Griffin diplomatically, "did you have breakfast?"
"Not yet," Corwin replied. "I wanted to get the comm dish housing cleared before..."
"No breakfast? That's no way for a growing boy to start the day," Aya insisted. "Come on, we'll go up to the New Orleans and get something at the Corellian House of Hotcakes. My treat. It's the least I can do for that show you gave me yesterday."
Corwin glanced at Utena, who grinned and said, "I'll go wash up."
"Okay, cool. Come on aboard," said Corwin, and the four of them went into Daggerdisk's wardroom. Corwin put the piece of shield generator down on the dining booth table, and while Utena disappeared into one of the staterooms, Corwin chatted with Aya and his father as he washed his face and hands in the galley sink. Utena returned presently, having cleaned the grease from her face and hands. She entered the wardroom belting on the Thorn of the Rose, which, being an unusual accessory for a teenage girl to have, caught Aya's attention immediately.
"Wow," the Free Spacer said after examining the intricate basket hilt for a moment. "That is a nice sword."
"Hm? Oh, thank you."
"Where'd you get it?" asked Aya.
"Corwin made it for my birthday," Utena told her. Aya blinked, impressed.
"Really? Corwin, you're so talented. Know how to use it?" she asked Utena with a speculative smile.
"Griffin-sensei thinks I do all right," Utena replied with a private sort of grin.
"Is that so?"
Aya asked Griffin, looking intrigued.
Griffin nodded. "She's beaten me on a good day," he confirmed. Aya Nakajima was in a position to know what that meant. She'd seen him in action several times, once against pretty long odds. Her eyes sparkled at the implications as she looked Utena over again in this new light.
"Oh-ho! Well, looks like plenty of room here," said Aya, gesturing to the mostly empty docking bay. "Let's try it out."
"Aya, come on," said Griffin. "You just met the girl. She hasn't had breakfast yet or anything."
"Yeah, you're right," said Aya, pouting. Then she shook it off and said brightly, "Okay, come on. Let's get some breakfast."
"Did you know," said Aya to Corwin after the waitress brought their pancakes, "you probably prevented a civil war?"
Corwin looked faintly confused. "Pardon?" he asked.
"Not an Earth civil war," Aya clarified. "A Federation one. I was ready to commit a full carrier task force to rescuing your friends, especially the Princess and Kate. We would have lost ships in that rescue. Earth Force would have lost more. Starfleet mightn't have gotten involved. And with that start, you have Corellia and Seleucia at each other's throats, the WDF against Starfleet, the Klingons trying to choose a side, Genom doing Buddha only knows what, and the Romulans and Cardassians swooping in to pick the bones."
Corwin blinked. Surprised? Asked Aya. I do consider these things. I think about them a lot, especially at 2 a.m. on a night without a party. But I was prepared to start that war, because the alternative, at the moment, was to let the Psi Corps get away with murder. Ben probably told you this already. If not, he should have, she went on, gesturing with her fork. We're looking at a war sometime in the next, oh, maybe 10 years. I think yesterday pushed that war back a bit. Earth Force had to back down. They've just realized their support isn't nearly as strong as they thought, and their personal defense force isn't strong enough yet to stand against the rest of the galaxy. Earth Force, the Psi Corps, even the Dome, they're going to back off for a while, until this incident is yesterday's news. But they aren't going to forget, or forgive, or change their goals. The Earth Alliance is back on its heels today, but it's still 25% of the entire Federation. Once the heat is off, they are going to arm. They're going to build a fleet big enough to challenge Seleucia, or us, or the WDF even. They're going to keep eating away at the Federation Starfleet until it becomes nothing more than a branch of Earth Force. They're going to find allies like the Corellians among the Federation, and run off minor powers until the Psi Act becomes law throughout the Federation. Or maybe worse. Aya paused, looking uncharacteristically grave, then put her hand on Corwin's shoulder and went on seriously. And when the war does come, Earth is gonna remember us, Corwin. Right now there's a bunch of Psi Corps officers very, very interested in you and your friends, and a bunch of Earth Alliance generals who want me on a barbecue spit, and a bunch of politicians who agree with all of them. They are gonna remember. So you need to be ready for when they try again. Griffin looked across the table at Utina, and, despite the gravity of what Aya was telling his son, smiled a private little smile, which she returned. Corwin, unnoticing, asked the Free Spacer Admiral, a trifle defensively, "What are you saying we should do, hide?" Aya snorted. "Hide? You? Hell no! Fight! I know your mother, kid. I know she's training you. Your father says that Utina here is good enough to beat him, and I trust his judgment. Both of you, keep learning. Keep practicing. Teach your friends. And when the time comes, when you have the chance to stop injustice and protect those you love, then the hell with the consequences. Do what is right." Corwin smiled, as if to counterbalance Aya's unwonted solemnity, and said, "My track record's pretty good." Aya grinned, her somber mood shattering, and she whomped Corwin on the shoulder in a man-to-man sort of way, rocking him sideways in his seat. "So I've seen," she said. "You just keep right on doing what you're doing. Keep your chin up and your eyes open. Don't be afraid, and you'll be fine." Aya slugged back the rest of her Singapore sling. With breakfast? Utina had thought when she'd ordered it. Put down the glass and stood up, smoothing her uniform. "Well," she hauled Corwin out of his seat and into a very snug embrace, shook Utina's hand with a wink, mussed up Griffin's hair, and said, "I gotta go run my fleet, or T'Pol will show up and drag me off by the ear." "I doubt T'Pol would do that," said Griffin with a lazy grin. "Oh," said Aya. "And why's that?" "Because," Griffin replied calmly. "That's Hamare's job. Right, Hamare?" Aya's eyes widened as her twin brother's thumb and forefinger closed on her left ear. "Ow!" she cried, drawing only a few glances from the staff and patrons of the restaurant. Everyone there was too used to her to react any more than that. "Come on, sis," said Hamare Nakajima resignedly. "There's a task force conference in 5 minutes. Captain? Kids?" he said with a cordial nod to Aya's table mates. "Ow, quit it, okay? I'm coming already. Let go!" Aya waved wildly as she was dragged away, shouting after her, "See you at the Rednecks barbecue. If you want a tour of my ship, set it up with Claire. Johnny! Ow, Hamare, damn it!" Corwin sat down, shaking his head. Only then did he notice that, though it seemed in retrospect as if she'd spent the entire time talking, Aya had nevertheless managed to put away no fewer than 6 pancakes, plus hash browns and sausage. Only crumbs and syrup traces remained on her plate.
"Remarkable woman," Griffin observed, having just noticed the same thing.
"Did she just stick us with a check?" Utrinum wondered.
"Of course not, miss," said their waiter jovially, pausing on his way to deliver a tray of food to another table in his zone. "Don't worry about a thing. Admiral Nakajima's tab at this house of hotcakes is legendary throughout the chain."
"Oh," said Utrinna.
"Why, some years ago," the Bolian went on, his eyes misting up nostalgically, "when the fleet was at Zardon, she treated the entire crew of a visiting WDF cruiser to breakfast here. 450 beings."
The waiter sighed wistfully.
"That was a good tip."
"Those waffles aren't going to serve themselves, Dremp," an irritable voice growled from the serving counter.
Dremp sighed again, more annoyed than wistful this time.
"One has so little time for pleasant conversation in this job," he observed as he bustled away. "Good day, all."
Juri Arisugawa had just emerged from the shower when she heard the merry little song of the door chime. Glancing down the short hallway from the bathroom, she saw that the door to the suite's master bedroom was still shut. Either there was no one in there, or whoever was left, someone he'd used the shower before Juri, was still asleep. Sighing, she pulled on her bathrobe, wrapped her thick orange hair in a towel to keep it from dripping all over everything, and went to answer the door. The person standing there was a young man with slightly tousled brown hair, dressed in the black and gray duty uniform of the International Police Space Force. Juri didn't recognize him, but she knew the uniform on sight, though she wasn't adept enough just yet to be able to tell the newcomer's rank from the single gold hash mark on his turtleneck collar. Apparently the uniformed boy, for he was only a boy, Juri knew looks could be deceiving, especially in this world, but he looked no older than Miki, was of the opinion that Juri outranked him. He came to attention and saluted, not visibly concerned that he was addressing a somewhat less than elegant late teenage girl in a towel turban and a rather damp white terry cloth bathrobe. "The captain's compliments, ma'am," said the uniformed young man briskly. "He wonders if you and your companions would care to lunch with him and his officers aboard Challenger this afternoon." Juri looked at the young officer with a straight face, though inside she was more amused than she'd been since this whole adventure had begun. "It's a good thing I answered the door and not Utrinna," she thought. "She might laugh in his face. She wouldn't mean any harm by it, but still, it would bruise his ego."
"My compliments to the captain," she replied smoothly, "and please tell him that we would be delighted, assuming I can wake the others."
"Thank you, ma'am," said the young officer gravely. "If you will report to Transporter Room 2, as near as noon as is convenient, you will be conveyed aboard promptly." He saluted again, pivoted smartly on his heel, and moved briskly off down the corridor. Juri watched him go, small smile hovering around the corners of her mouth, then went back inside and let the bulkhead door close behind her before chuckling softly.
"Something funny?" inquired Caitlin Hutchins as she emerged from the master bedroom, looking slightly owlish without her glasses, hair mussed, tiger pajamas rumpled.
"We've been invited to lunch with your father aboard his starship," she said. "The young man they sent to convey the invitation..."
Juri shook her head, chuckling again. The young man's earnestness had been almost painful. He'd reminded her of Miki, before he'd learned to take things easier.
"Let's say he took his work very seriously."
In a small but comfortably appointed two-room suite in Red Sector, Elizabeth Broadbank sat at the bedroom desk and stared hard at the face of her father's robotic secretary, as if willing the machine's head to explode.
"If you'll just tell him it's me calling," she began, but 709 cut her off flatly. Mr. Broadbank is in an important meeting and has left instructions that he is not to be disturbed. Your message will be conveyed. I can do no more.
Liza felt herself starting to boil over and clamped a lid down over it. She was in enough trouble without pitching a tantrum at a stupid answer bot that didn't know better.
Fine, she said with an effort. You have my number here?
Yes, 709 replied. Thank you for calling As Technology.
Liza stared at the Babcom logo for a few moments, then sighed and threw herself down on the bed.
Suit yourself, she said to no one. It's not like I'm going anywhere.
The hostelries of the CFA New Orleans are located close to the four main docking bays of the ship, especially in the forward quarter of the vessel, next to the vast docking bay 1 and the 24 privately owned repair bays there. In the forward area, near the broad, kilometer-long main corridor linking DB-1 and the processional at the center of the ship, were the Hilton Free Space, the Barony Arms New Orleans, the hut-owned Zlato's Lotto, all the Free Spacer Nation's high-class hotels, except for the rooms at Calrissian's on the processional. When the refugees from the Worcester Preparatory Institute arrived on the New Orleans, the powers that be decided not to board underage schoolchildren in a casino hotel. So it was that, on the morning after arrival, Mia Ausser found herself waking in one of the Hilton's luxury suites, single bedrooms. Unaccustomed to sleeping human style, she had a disagreeable crick in her neck and a persistent, irrational feeling that she had somehow courted ill fortune by spending a night in the room's enormous bed, but both faded during her morning ablutions. By the time she emerged from the bathroom and dressed, she felt pretty much normal. Like the others, she'd escaped with minimal packing. She had a single valise, a black leather one like a portable computer case, and had brought only one set of clothes, her Anlashok battle uniform. This was a good choice for the possibility of a protracted lack of resources. Sturdy and made of highly resistant fabrics, it would stay clean considerably longer than normal clothing. As she sat down to brush her long black hair, she switched on the small data term built into the bedroom desk and set it to Network 23, her father's network. A moment later, her hairbrush clattered to the floor as she saw his face, and behind it, the wreckage of the wedge back on the WPI campus. "It's all over here now, but the administrative screaming," John Trussell's face said, but Mia didn't hear him. She was too busy trying to get her heart started again.
"In Phelan's name," she murmured. "They sent him? Are they mad?"
Then she gathered her wits, shaking her head. "Of course," she reminded herself. "They don't know how dangerous it is, and he wouldn't refuse the assignment." She felt a little better when she noticed the blinking red rebroadcast icon flashing in the corner of the screen. If anything had happened to him, they wouldn't be rerunning his earlier report, would they? That depended on the ratings. Mia fumbled with the terminal controls, deactivating its TV function and punching in a communications code instead. The Hilton "Please Wait" graphic appeared, cycled a few times, and then the face of a receptionist appeared.
"Good morning, Network 23," said the receptionist.
"News department, please," said Mia, sounding considerably more collected than she felt. "I must speak with John Trussell."
"Who is calling, please?"
"My name is Mia Ausser. I'm his daughter."
"One moment, please."
The screen switched to a Network 23 version of that same standard "please wait" screen, then back to the receptionist.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Trussell is in the field at this time. Would you like to leave him vidmail?"
"No," said Mia, feeling herself edge toward desperation. "What about his producer?"
"One moment, please," said the receptionist in the same blandly pleasant tone. The screen went to the "please wait" image a third time, then blipped to a different face. Mia felt herself partly relax, for this face was a friendly one, one she recognized.
"Theora," said Mia. "Where's Murph?"
"Catching some sleep in the break room.
replied Network 23 News Director Theora Carter. We're on hour 25 of the Worcester crisis, if you start counting from the first reports of the WPI campus lockdown. Theora smiled. Worried about your dad? I just saw the rerun, him standing in front of the wedge. Is he all right? He's fine. Theora looked mildly surprised. Why wouldn't he be? Your own involvement aside, it's just another story. Just another story. Right. Mia forced an unaggressive look of relief onto her face. Can you link me through to him? I'd really like to talk to him. Sure. Hold on. Again with the please wait graphic. And then Mia had to make herself not recoil in horror from what she saw next. Al, John Trussell's cybernetic controller, had a fondness for rendering himself in what he considered to be the cutting edge of human fashions. Unfortunately, no one had ever been able to determine just where Al had acquired his notions of what was and was not fashionable, and so his virtual wardrobe tended to be rather eye-bending. Today he was sporting something in alternating verdigris and Romulan-ale-blue iridescent diagonal stripes, which, at the distance he was from the camera, interfered with the Galactic Video Communications Encoding Standard quite remarkably. "Hey!" said Al delightedly. "Mia! How are you, honey? You and your friends have this place in quite an uproar." "I'm fine, Al. Is Dad there?" "He's sacked out in the back. We're on our way back to Sydney. Not much more to see in Worcester now that Tremaine's out of the job."
"Director Tremaine was fired?"
"Oh, yeah. They sent him to the moon. He's going to be chasing dust bunnies for the next couple of years. That's what happens when you nearly get the Earth destroyed. You want me to wake up your old man for you?"
"Please."
"No problem. Hey, hey! One of you bucketheads wake up the boss. His daughter's on the phone for him."
"Mr. Trussell has had only 2 hours of sleep," a single sideband vocoder voice intoned from somewhere off-screen. Another, similar voice, pitched slightly lower, added, "Humans require 6 to 8 for..."
"Did I ask for a biology report?" Al demanded.
"No! Wake him up!
Stupid machines!"
He looked apologetically at Mia.
"Sorry. It's so hard to find good help these days."
A second later, the screen changed again, this time to a view of a rather disheveled, puffy-eyed John Trussell. His sleep-blurred face brightened considerably when he saw his daughter.
"Mia," he said, smiling. "I was going to try calling you when I woke up. Where are you?"
"The Free Spacer home fleet at Bajor," said Mia. "Dad, what the hell were you thinking?"
Truss raised an eyebrow. "Excuse me?" he asked. "There was a story to cover. I covered it. That's my job."
"Stop it," Mia replied. "You know what I mean. What in the world possessed you to walk right up to a psychop and stick a camera in his face?"
"What was I supposed to do, hide out in Sydney and tell Murph to send somebody else?"
"You were involved, Mia. I couldn't just stay home. Besides, I'm fine. Tremaine was too preoccupied to suspect a thing."
"I suppose. But it's so dangerous. Why can't you get out of there? Ask for a transfer to one of the off-world bureaus. Get away from Earth before they tighten the restrictions or issue a blanket rescreening."
"Most of the network's off-world bureaus are still within the Earth Alliance," said Truss.
"They must be planning to open one on Babylon 5, Mia pointed out.
"I imagine so, but I haven't heard anything definite."
"Ask for that, please. Edison will give it to you, I know he will. You could tell him why if you had to."
Truss looked like he wanted to chuckle, but he didn't, because he knew his daughter was taking this all very seriously. Instead, he considered for a few moments, then sighed and said,
"All right, Mia. I'll ask about it as soon as I get back to headquarters. Where are you headed next?"
"I'm not sure. There's been talk of Zeta Cygni giving us asylum until everything can be sorted out. I think Kate's father is working on it."
Truss nodded.
Okay, that's all in good hands, then. Can you keep me posted? I'll let you know as soon as I find anything out on this end.
All right.
Mia paused, then went on. Thank you for looking into it. When I saw that you had gone there, I don't think I've ever been so scared.
Truss smiled ruefully.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't even think of it at the time. I'll let you know what happens, okay?
Okay.
Love you.
I love you too, Dad. Bye for now.
Mia broke the connection, then sighed. Aunt Delenn was right about her father, she decided. He could be so difficult sometimes. Not long afterward, a properly uniformed Harcourt Mackenzie rousted his fellow refugees from their Hilton luxury suites and, wielding a credit chit from the CFMF home fleet, stated that the fleet was rescuing them from the horrors of room service, or worse yet, the complimentary continental breakfast. After breakfast, if the brand new communicator on his belt didn't beep anyway, a leisurely sightseeing trip would be possible, anything from the grand shops of the central processional to the grubby but colorful booths and pavilions of the bazaar. The others, although unresponsive to the prospect of shopping with the minor amount of cash available among them, greeted the prospect of a truly gourmet breakfast with approval. A few morning ablutions, changes of clothes for those who brought them, and a prolonged assembly of the group later, Mac led his fellow students to a turbo lift which deposited them within short walking distance of the Imperial Centauri Diner. Anything you desire, by your command. Despite the vast disparity of human, Hoffmanite, Narn, Skrang, Dantrovian, and Minbari palates, the short-order cook didn't bat an eye as Mac ordered his favorite breakfast, pigs in a blanket, bantha bacon and two eggs scrambled with toast and blue apple jam, and encouraged his companions to do likewise. Conversation was muted over the loud and enthusiastic clattering of the other patrons' plates and cutlery, and muted still more as the orders came up, done to the perfection of a cook with a gift for knowing what every culture's version of a greasy spoon is and how to mimic it. The food was not what any of the diners would call haute cuisine. It was, more importantly, good food, prepared in such a way as to remind one not of a chef, but of family and home, or the little café down the block. Although Jacron complained as a matter of form, having had nothing but a glass of hing juice, everyone else was quite satisfied with both service and food. Mac had to wave off a couple of attempts to tip. Not only would the Centauri staff be offended, but they would add an extra charge to the fleet's bill anyway. Thus far undisturbed by Mac's communicator, the group adjourned to the corridors of the New Orleans, fortified by a hearty meal, for some serious rubbernecking. As the shops and bazaar stalls opened for business, black and gold banners rose across the high ceilings of the corridors. Video displays everywhere replayed again and again the arrival of the 6th Carrier Task Force. Footage of the kids immediately after beaming onto the New Orleans, even footage from the Dagger Disc's narrow escape from Earth's defense grid. Placards razzing the Psi-Corps, the Earth Ministry of Peace, and various other causes rose from every corner, including not a few sales racks. The Freespacer Nation, it seemed, was suffering an acute attack of patriotism, and for some peculiar reason the WPI students stood at the core of it all. Mac's attempts to encourage store browsing proved an embarrassing failure. Every store owner greeted them at the door and practically piled free merchandise onto the victim of choice. Mia, for instance, who'd had very few possessions at WPI, found her material wealth doubled in 5 minutes when a Corellian free trader loaded her down with one of every Minbari import in his shop. Immediately afterward came a photograph, a pose, and a handshake, with business cards slipped in hand for future business. When a bookstore attempted to offer Jacron a spokesperson contract, Mac finally broke off the entire thing and hustled the group back to the hotel before someone began sewing corporate logos on their clothing. I really am sorry, Mac sighed as the turbolift rushed them back to the hotel district. Usually the word free isn't in the free spacer vocabulary. Jacron looked confused.
Yes, it is, he observed. It's in your very name.
Mac sighed. You know what I mean.
I do, said Jacron, looking still more puzzled.
It's all right, said Azalin, who had made the error of walking into two stores, a candle shop and a bladesmith, and now bore two votive candles, a foot-long aromatic candle, and a complete set of ceremonial colonial warrior blades, plus a coupon for half off a blaster to complete the armament. I've got a terrific head start on my Christmas shopping.
Things should calm down in a few days, Mac continued. Another time, when our faces aren't on FNS every 30 minutes, there's a lot I'd like to show you.